Once you get into the reading, you see that actually Islam is probably the closest religion to Christianity, and it may well be that because of our conservatism, we hold to many things that are traditionally important to Christians rather more than many churchgoers do. So it's probably the case that a higher proportion of British Muslims believe in the virgin birth than churchgoing Anglicans.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the deep values of people from a wide range of political, metaphysical, and professional perspectives. My guest today is Dr. Tim Winter, who is also known as Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad, and he is an Islamic theologian. Tim, I am going to kick off by asking you, what is sacred to you?
I suppose there is the objective sacred, which is what human beings since the Upper Paleolithic have experienced as something mysteriously inhering in the beauty of nature, relationships, the human face, just the enigma of being, which probably all human beings, just by virtue of being human, have experienced probably quite frequently in their lives, even if they don't have the right vocabulary to explore it. And the subjective sacred, which is how we, from our particular culturally specific class-based, gender-based, education-based, mental cultural formation, actually receive and interpret that. So my own experience of the sacred has been, I suppose, an attempt to interpret that universal and probably most important of human sensations, that behind the surface of the world, there is something that gives sense and meaning and direction to the world, for me has always been most easily interpreted in the language of traditional Semitic monotheism, that the sacred principle, the light, the goodness, the beauty, the experienced truth behind things, is an enigma that is least bafflingly articulated in the limited net of human language in terms of there being a kind of analogy to a person who, rather than what, is the origin and the end and the purpose of everything. That's the most that my limited Western mind can encompass, I think. I have enormous respect for other traditions which are less personalist, some of the Buddhist traditions, for instance, some of the Indic traditions, Chinese traditions, but I'm very much from the far west of the old world, and I can only see the sacred as being interpreted in terms of there being personal life as the author and the ground of being.
You use this phrase Semitic monotheism. Could you unpack that a little bit for me?
Well, monotheism as historically expressed through the Hebrew prophets and articulated in terms of the Abrahamic idea of a personal God, a God that in some mysterious allegorical way weaves stories that enable us to pick up on the fragments of light and meaning that we see in our lives and to see a greater purpose, the stories which are often moral. So I suppose by Semitic monotheism, I mean Abrahamic religion, the belief in a single personal creator God who creates in time and who resurrects and to whom there will be a final reckoning. So unlike, say, the Dharmic religions of the subcontinent, where history is more cyclical than linear, and the divine is mediated in more complex ways.
Mm. Yes, I really like that phrase you used, who not what, as a way of gesturing towards that personalist understanding of God.
With all the paradoxes that generates, of course.
Yes. I can hear the care. And I love that when I'm sort of trying to write or speak about this hugely semiotically dense three letters God, I have sometimes put it in square brackets to acknowledge that we are talking with something that needs, you know, we need not to fling it around as if everyone knows what we're talking about or as if it is uncomplicated as a concept. Okay, we're going to try to locate you in your story and how you came to have that instinctive underlying logic in your life. So I'd love to hear about your childhood. Could you just paint me a picture of young Tim, maybe 8 or 9? What was your world and what were you like?
Well, no adventures really. Middle class, mediocre, middle of the road, middle England. Brought up in a leafy North London suburb. Went to private schools I was at a school called Westminster, which at the time was undergoing one of its sort of summits of cultural production. Every evening, some bunch of earnest, slightly nerdy pupils were putting on some Samuel Beckett play, and everybody was terribly taxed by the latest articles in the Times Literary Supplement. And in some ways, it was artificial and seedy, but in other ways, it did actually confirm our sense that the life of the mind was interesting, that education is not just about pointing one like a gun at the stockbroker belt from an early age, whatever parents might have intended, but was an attempt to explore, albeit it was a very secular school, the deep mystery of human consciousness and the fact that we are capable, despite our humble origins, of quite enormous profundity. The fact that out of the total chaos of the Big Bang, you can have processes that lead to the immense subtlety of Shakespeare, for instance, is itself, although we tended to regard that as a rather uncool way of arguing, is a kind of pointer towards the existence of kind of guiding, meaning-laden principles in the universe that, despite the tendency of matter to be entropic and to wind down into greater chaos and greater disorder, nonetheless produces structures which enable greater forms of order to develop, leading ultimately, it was a humanistic interpretation, but quite a convincing one, to the deep miracle of human consciousness, human creativity, the perception of the beauty, the perception that in morality there is something deep and eternal that touches us, that I think was probably quite a good preparation for many of us. And I've stayed in touch with some of my school friends since then. Just
my goodness, you're reminding me of an interview I did with Ian McGilchrist, who spoke about his, mm-hmm. he went to Winchester College, as yep. similarly very, very terrible formative place. On his worldview yep. as, were they the rivals?
Well, in cricket, you know, there was just an ongoing issue.
Hmm. I see. It's the Sharks and the Jets transposed mm-hmm. to public schools. But I think for, you know, for me and for a lot of listeners, that was not our experience of school. So it's very helpful to hear how early on those questions were live for you. Were they live at home? Tell me about your parents, if you don't mind. What kind of world were they forming for you?
My father was regarded as one of the leading exponents of architectural modernism in the UK. So he got his gong from the Queen and was president of the Royal Institute of British Architects for a while and member of the Royal Fine Arts Commission. So I was brought up with kind of art and architecture. I remember at the age of about six being taken to my first David Hockney exhibition. I think it was the Whitehall Gallery, and looking with some legitimate sort of six-year-old perplexity at some of Hockney's images. But we were certainly immersed in that world of modernism, the excitement of the 1960s, 1970s, that the old ways were being kicked away, the dusty Gothic kind of repetitiveness of the old England, and we were going to move into a rather more, I suppose, Californian space where the sky was the limit, entrepreneurship, new forms, new excitement. And I was brought up in what is sometimes regarded as London's leading sort of showcase of modernist domestic architecture, which is a house in the middle of Highgate Cemetery, which is still kind of a point of pilgrimage for a lot of modernists and is a wow. listed building and so forth. So I was brought up with the big windows
it.
And the steel. He designed it, yeah. So I was brought up in the middle, right of the cutting edge of modernity, with my father, who at the time was a kind of convinced follower of Bertrand Russell and thought that religion was pretty nice at Christmas, but one really needed to move on into the world of steel and glass and Le Corbusier and Mies van der Rohe. And so at our dinner table, we would quite often have leading modernist architects. Norman Foster was a kind of rival back in the 1970s. They competed against each other in competitions. Various other sort of leading names in the modernist movement would float across my sort of skeptical teenage radar. So that had a kind of impact in that I was at the sharp end of modernity, looking at the steel and glass alternative to, you know, the Gothic traditions of Merry England.
And am I right in thinking you had some quite committed ministers in the generation above you? Was that your dad's parents who were in ministry?
Well, the deeper family history was a little street in Norwich, And I did the research once to see exactly whether there'd been anybody in my family tree who'd ever done anything of any interest whatsoever, won a medal perhaps, or built a bridge. And I found silence. Yeah, so we lived for about 200 years on King Street in Norwich. We had a draper's shop and we're kind of prosperous working class, I suppose. And we lived more or less opposite what is now known and celebrated as the shrine of Mother Julian of Norwich. But of course, as devout Congregationalist, Calvinist chapel folk, we never darkened its doors. It was regarded as a kind of shocking relic of popery, and it was just as well that it was falling to pieces. And who would possibly go there for that idolatrous rank popery? So that was a kind of... But the chapel Congregationalist world was really the center of everybody's life until certainly my grandfather's generation, when everybody would take the pledge. My grandfather would walk up.
What was the pledge?
The pledge was to lay off the demon drink forever. And you would go up to the altar, put your hand on the Bible and swear off drink forevermore.
Right.
And interestingly, that same structure, or the Sunday school attached to it, and I have dim recollections as a rather grumpy child having to go to Sunday school, it's actually become a mosque. So I now tell my family in Norwich, you know, I'm the only one who's keeping up the family tradition. I still go to that place and I still don't drink. I don't know about you guys. And they give me a look. But it's always been important to me to recognize that the monotheisms are closely intertwined and similar, and that taking the step into something like Islam is not visiting Mars or some remote elsewhere. It's a different variation on the same principles of Semitic monotheism. So yes, that sanctuary of my family, going back, I suppose, at least 200 years, is now a mosque, very busy mosque, lots of converts, very active place. So there's an irony.
And do you think your dad was reacting against that world in his kind of Bertrand Russell 1960s modernist world?
Yeah, I think he was. I think that if you're brought up in the 40s and 50s in an English provincial town, everything must have seemed extremely mediocre and dull and monochrome. This is before multiculturalism, before the sexual revolution, before the Beatles. And if you had any kind of intelligence, and I've inherited his library, and he was reading, you know, very extensively and interested in art and architecture from his early teens, it must have seemed extremely disappointing, kind of a waste of one's life. The sort of Edwardian preoccupations with virtue signalling within the old English class system, where you went to take your tea, which theatres you went to and didn't go to, where you sat in chapel. All of that was, I think, extremely oppressive to a lot of people, which accounts for the extraordinary explosion that happened in the 1960s. That was an energetic, chaotic, in many ways destructive reaction against something that by that time had become almost unbearable to a generation that had wireless and TV and movies and was seeing a wider world. So I think that he formed part of that. And his reaction was to look to where he thought the life and the vigor and the sincerity was in the Western world, which was in the United States. He loved America. He did his master's at Yale. Then he drove across the continent in a converted, I think it was a funeral wagon or something. I guess petrol was cheap in those days. He drove all the way to California, worked for a leading architectural firm there called Skidmore, built his first skyscraper. And he experiences America as a land of possibility, of openness, of friendliness, and of a lack of the kind of forensic class differentials, which were the great preoccupation of England at that time.
Hi, I wondered if I could ask for your help. You may have noticed that we've been doing a lot of work behind the scenes to make this channel more beautiful, more enriching, more thought-provoking, and more life-giving. But 87% of you watching on this channel are not yet subscribed. So I wondered if you would just hit the little subscribe button. It means that you'll get these really thoughtful conversations in your feed, and it will also help other people find us. Thanks very much. So given that background, it would have been very easy for you to just default to atheism. But it sounds like, you know, at Westminster School, surrounded by the cathedral and this liturgy, religion was always something you were interested in some form. Is that fair to say?
I think that there was something so nonconformist about Westminster School in the 70s, encouraged by its maverick headmaster, John Ray, who regarded being different as being part of the individualistic possibilities of the Enlightenment. And he would actively encourage eccentric behavior as long as it, you know, didn't involve drugs or alcohol. He kind of actively promoted this world of intellectual exploration. That the conventional sort of disregard for the idea of religion was perhaps slightly less common. And there were a few earnest Christians at the school. In a sense, it was uncool to consider religion to be uncool, unlike many school kids. And every morning we were praying at Westminster Abbey and experiencing the beauty of the building and the liturgy. And even though the headmaster was just as likely to read a rather disturbing Kafka short story as he was to read something from St. Paul. It was that kind of place. And of course, girls arrived when I was there, which was another kind of strain on the traditional sort of public school ethos. But we had a chaplain, Willie Booth, who then went on to become Queen's chaplain, I think, for a while, a kind of mild-mannered Ulsterman who put up with our endless sort of jeering and gave us an example of somebody who is living a kind of humble Christian life. That we noticed, even though not many kids went up for confirmation or went to Compline in the Abbey. It was a very secular place. But he did encourage us to think not just about, is there a God, but also, you know, about the historical doctrinal claims of Christianity, which he took seriously. So he exposed us to the doctrine of the Trinity, to the vicarious atonement, to the dual nature of Christ, the history of the church councils. This was in a rather kind of vague God slot, which still existed back then, called divinity, which didn't lead to a proper O-level or anything. So it was a kind of chance to muck around. But given the nature of the school, we mucked around in ways that satisfied a certain intellectual curiosity. But it has to be said that very few of the kids actually bought his kind of presentation of traditional church Christianity. The Trinity didn't seem to make sense to us. Three into one don't go. That kind of argument seemed to us conclusive. And towards the end of the decade, when theology still made it to the front pages in the English press, there was a scandal over a book called The Myth of God Incarnate, which was edited by radical theologians like John Hick, which claimed that the historical Jesus would not have voted the right way at the church councils, that he was practicing Judaism. He wouldn't have accepted being a person of a Trinity. He didn't believe in the dual nature or original sin or any of those doctrines that emerged in the early Christian centuries. So that kind of, for me, segued into a certain skepticism that had come out of those rather ill-fated and combative divinity classes that had punctuated my teenage years.
So you became a Unitarian for a while, I gather, through sort of part of that journey. What was drawing you there?
Well, I had always retained the conviction through various maverick personal experiences that the least absurd explanation of the great mystery, the enigma of being, is that there is a divine principle behind it. I never lost sight of that, although I was tested on a few occasions, usually in moments of tragedy. But the idea of a triune God, the idea of the church as currently constituted, the kind of bells and smells of high church ritual, or even some of the things that we did in Westminster Abbey, as faithfully reflecting the lifestyle, the beliefs, the purposes of that amazing Jesus of Nazareth, whose teachings kind of shine through as something that can't be interpreted just as a kind of interesting product of first century Palestinian Jewish Hasidic piety, but somehow transcend time and space and do speak to us of the sacred, of universals, that there was a disconnect between the Christ of faith and the Jesus of history. And I found reading things like John Hick's stuff, Dennis Nynum, people like that, theologians who were active at the time, Don Cupid, that actually the historical Jesus is more attractive and speaks to us more than the kind of glorified Pantocrator Christ raised in heaven, judging the quick and the dead. So it seemed to me to be like a choice between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. And that didn't sort of trigger some kind of total meltdown for me, but an option for the Jesus of history, the amazing wandering rabbi of first century Galilee with his very radical but deep and intuitively moving teachings, the parables, the ethos of early, of first primitive Christianity, as opposed to the kind of golden Byzantine splendor and Hellenized doctrines that came after several centuries. So that was, if you like, my first semi-conscious religious decision that I wanted to learn more about the Jewish Jesus.
Yeah. And I have heard you speak about going up to university as a Unitarian and ending up studying Arabic because you wanted to make a lot of money in the Gulf.
Yes.
Westminster clearly hadn't left you solely with, high intellectual aspirations. There were other aspirations going on. It was the route into studying Arabic and learning about Islam was more accidental than deliberate by the sound of it.
Yeah, I mean, by that stage, all of my friends who in their teenage years were listening to kind of contemporary opera and Harrison Birtwistle and going to the Tate Gallery every week, they'd kind of emerged from the chrysalis and they were working in the city or sort of getting proper jobs and actually joining the establishment. I suppose my trajectory at that time was, in Islam, we emphasize very strongly the value of intention. Intention matters more than what you actually do. And probably my intentions have never been particularly impeccable. So my options, I took the entrance exam to Cambridge in economics. And then I decided to switch to do Arabic, which for various extraneous reasons I'd taken an interest in my mid-teens. So looking at the rather intense hothouse economics then being doled out in the economics faculty in Cambridge, I thought, my God, this is 3 years of statistics and economic projections that probably will never turn out to be true. Okay, I'll get a job with Citibank at the end of it. But so I kind of chickened out and went back into the hard humanities and chose the Arabic studies tripos with a small number of almost necessarily like-minded, unusual students, and didn't regret it, although Arabic is difficult. It wasn't necessarily an easy option.
Yes. And another part of your journey that I'd love to hear about, although obviously talking about it is reasonably personal, was a sense of the way Christianity relates to sexuality versus how Islam does. Would you mind saying a little bit about that moment in your life?
I suppose this also is something which is important to people who come out of the 1960s, the 1970s, when the traditional kind of dusty Puritanism that was normal in England really throughout the 1950s, the sense of shame and the problematizing of something which is the most elemental aspect of our biological humanity was the main thing that people were rebelling about in the 1960s. By the 1970s, it had become clear that there needed to be some kind of boundaries regulation. Otherwise, people were going to get hurt, especially women. A lot of news coming out about cults in California, free love communes and so forth. And usually it was the women who were on the receiving end of most of those free love experiments. But certainly I believe that we are designed, whether by evolution or providence or both, to be inhabitants of the upper Paleolithic environment. In other words, to be part of the natural world. We're physically organic beings. And on that level, the production of life, and therefore a certain awe and reverence for the processes whereby life comes to be, is normal for human beings. And the earliest of all images are images of sort of fertility goddesses or pregnant women. We're not quite sure what they were because they go back to 40,000 BC. And it struck me that the type of religion, not just Christianity, that problematizes that, that emphasizes, for instance, clerical celibacy, that associates eros with some primordial fault in creation, the idea that reproduction is a consequence of original sin, Once we became mortal, we had to reproduce ourselves. Obviously, these are nowadays hotly contested topics in Christianity, but looking at the normative medieval or even very recent sort of chapel Christian attitude struck me that quite a bit of damage could be done to human beings by problematizing something which is the most fundamental drive that we have. And that most religions, in fact, certainly not just Islam, but Judaism, many schools of Hinduism and so forth actually have a very positive sense of sacred sexuality, and the leading thinkers produce pillow books, and that natural process is regarded as something sacred rather than a consequence of the loss of the sacred. So that, again, in the context of the 1970s, was something that was quite significant to me, that Christianity in many of its forms, although the Reformation had allowed priests to marry, had possibly done quite a bit of damage to human beings by trying to suffocate that which sooner or later will express itself. And perhaps some of these abuse scandals that have hit some of the churches in recent years are evidence of the fact that this is a renegade, very powerful instinct, and you need to provide a space in which it can be celebrated and sacralized rather than treated as a kind of sort of concession to human nature.
Yes. It was really interesting reading that because it's not something I think in the public perception of Islam that is you know, and that part of the reason I like to talk to people, to interview people is to understand where their lived experience is very different from the kind of two-dimensional picture that we paint. But the fact that part of what drew you to Islam was your perception of it having a healthier understanding of sexuality was very interesting to me. So there was that piece, there was the Arabic course that drew you into this world. What pushed you over the edge to not just becoming interested in Islam, but committing your life to it?
There wasn't a kind of road to Damascus moment, I suppose, or any sort of angelic intervention. It was rather a slow process of migration from a sort of pieties of Westminster Abbey to a sort of rather thin, perhaps Unitarian interpretation of Christianity, to a survey of different religious options, because this is the 1970s and people were following Rajneesh and Hare Krishna all over central London. It was an interesting time when the rebellion against the hard edges of modernity was actually frequently expressed in religious and sacred terms. Which has almost been completely lost sight of now. The kind of Extinction Rebellion is largely a secular organization, as far as I can see. That tendency has joined the secular bandwagon. But back in the 70s, it wasn't the case. People were genuinely interested in the sacred in realistic or dangerous ways. So it was a slow migration, I suppose, from the Trinity to the idea of a kind of pure Semitic monotheism, as I understood it. And then perhaps a slight experience of being underwhelmed by the Unitarian Chapel in Cambridge. The fact that I seemed to be about the only person there who wasn't yet of retirement age possibly didn't help. It didn't look like the charismatic repository of final truth to me. And because I'd started to learn Arabic for quite extraneous materialistic reasons, the penny started to drop that I seemed to be drawn in the direction of something that originally I hadn't really had any interest in. I'm not somebody who seeks out exotica or the mystic East. I was never on the hippie trail. I have no interest in something that dislocates me from what I already am in sort of fundamental nature. And one of the things about joining Islam, which I've seen with a lot of new Muslims, is that it, in a strange way, tends to situate them more strongly in their sort of local identity. Some of the most English people I've ever met have been converts to Islam, and that's one of the interesting, unexpected, unlooked-for aspects of it, that it doesn't suddenly turn you into a hand-clapping sort of dervish, but relocates you and helps you to see what's of value in what has been lost in the last 50 years or so, although, of course, with a new set of beliefs. But people in this time where everybody believes in polarities and Islam is figured as the kind of dark other, sort of yellow peril, the antithesis of everything that we hold dear in the West, and of course we saw that dangerously on our streets just last week with the riots. There are a lot of polarities at the moment across Europe in particular. Once you get into the reading, you see that actually Islam is probably the closest religion to Christianity. And it may well be that because of our conservatism, we hold to many things that are traditionally important to Christians rather more than many churchgoers do. So it's probably the case that a higher proportion of British Muslims believe in the virgin birth than church-going Anglicans. That would be my guess. I find many of them, because I talk to church groups sometimes, are quite skeptical about some of these traditional stories and miracles. So Islam is the only non-Christian religion that has an honored place for Jesus of Nazareth as the Messiah, born of a virgin, bearer of a great scripture, somebody who will come again at the end of time as judge, which is not the case for if you're moving into, say, the Hare Krishna or into Taoism or into some New Age group. And of course, when Islam emerged in the 7th century, many of the first Christians who looked at it with kind of astonishment said, actually, this isn't a new religion. This is a Christian heresy. If they believe in Jesus and Abraham and the prophets, it's a kind of Christianity. It's really weird, stranger than the Arians and some of those other groups that came to be defined as heretical. I don't see Islam as a Christian heresy. It clearly is a separate religion. But the fact that it has frequently been perceived as such indicates that actually the gulf that one jumps is not nearly as yawning and terrifying as you might think. So I experience it as a slow continuum rather than a sudden bolt from the blue, a sudden changing of my personality and worldview.
And how did your family react?
Well, again, we're talking about 1979, the heyday of middle-class panic about teenagers joining cults. So, of course, they thought, oh, dear, this is exactly what's happened to our Timmy. And look, he's not eating bacon for breakfast any longer, and he doesn't go to the pub, and he doesn't seem to have girlfriends, and we must get to the bottom of this. So they made some inquiries, and they visited some of the Muslim groups, main convert groups that I was associating with at the time. And I think looking at my mother's diary, because she wrote all of this down, she wrote 80 volumes of diaries, so I have a kind of window into her mind. I think she was quite reassured when she saw that there were plenty of other sort of middle-of-the-road, middle-class English people at the time who were becoming Muslim, and that I wasn't going to come back with four Sudanese wives and practice some kind of animal sacrifice on the front lawn. Even then, there was a lot of what we now call Islamophobia and misgivings, and this is even before Khomeini, before the whole fundamentalist horror had burst onto people's awareness. So I think that after a year or so, their anxieties were settled, and then I got married and they had grandchildren, and things became pretty normal. And I guess it was nice for them to have a child who still believed and respected the old stories that had been important to my ancestors. Those stories are basically there in the Quran. So it took a bit of persuading to explain to them that this is actually a kind of something that's in continuity with the other monotheisms rather than something from planet Neptune that is entirely unrecognizable and rather frightening.
Yes. You've touched on a few things that, you know, some of the stories that are told about Islam, about sexuality and about, you know, radical discontinuity with Christianity. For listeners who have very little understanding of Islam or don't know any Muslims, what are the key things you wish they understood that might help them when they're seeking to be people who can listen and engage across these kind of differences?
Some I've not mentioned already. A lot of Christians don't know that there's more about the Virgin Mary in the Quran than there is in the Gospels, for instance. Marian piety, very important in the Islamic world. Just yesterday I was translating a text about the death of the Virgin Mary from a 12th century Central Asian scholar writing in what's called Middle Turkic. So even in that remote place years ago, 8 centuries ago, Muslims considered it important to write devotional poetry that would be chanted in devotional settings about things that Christians often think are kind of uniquely theirs. It's important to recognize that the religion is very family-oriented in terms of what we call the organic rather than the nuclear family. So even today, in quite humble accommodation in Muslim areas of Britain, you will find grandparents still cared for in the home. This is a very important part of the traditional Muslim ethic, and they play an important part in looking after children. There is also, of course, the prayer, five times a day, starting at dawn. We face the Abraham's house in Mecca and bow to the Lord of the universe. And that is something that is really the most characteristic watchword of Islam, and mosques everywhere are full, because people actually love these practices. An important thing to realize is that Muslims actually continue to be religious because we actually love what we do. We love our prophet. We love God. It's very love-based. If you look at classical Muslim devotional literature, you'll see the principle of love is foremost. Everybody now reads Rumi, for instance, who's kind of made the leap into the New Age world and is actually the best-selling religious poet in the United States now, even though he was an imam from what's now Afghanistan. So at the height of the war of terror, on terror, Americans still found themselves opening their hearts to, you know, this form of traditional Muslim love-based piety. That aspect of the religion, I think, needs to be better understood because it's pretty universal. It's about beauty, it's about love, compassion, humor, and those texts are absolutely axiomatic across the traditional Islamic world. So sometimes there's a kind of improper importation of a letter versus spirit dichotomy, that Muslims are all about lots of complicated rules, like the nasty old rabbis allegedly criticized and abrogated by the New Testament writers, and that now we're supposed to be free in the spirit, and that's much more spiritual and real. I don't think that's, it's essentially an anti-Semitic trope, because Jewish literature is full of ecstatic references to the God that one loves, and the dancing rabbis, for instance, a familiar phenomenon. Rabbis seem to dance a lot more than Church of England vicars do. We need to overcome that binary to see that there's a lot of joy, happiness, love in those Semitic traditions. And I've certainly found that to be the case in Islam as well, that throughout its literature, you know, I'm a lecturer in Islamic studies, I spend my life in the libraries, and I find that joy, that love, that preoccupation with human and natural beauty to be something that is a constant for Muslims and is often not understood by outsiders.
Yes, thank you. That's beautiful. And I kind of want to ask you about key differences as well. One of my frustrations with some of the way kind of interfaith engagement goes is because I think we have a really faulty theology of difference. We see it as a threat, not a gift. We try and elide difference and only focus on, and there are huge commonalities. But I'm thinking particularly of something I read where you were talking about your early encounter with Muhammad, and through a text that wasn't particularly, helpful about him, but the sense of Muhammad as someone who stood up against oppression, and you use this phrase like a Che Guevara with God. Would you like to, I wonder if there is something, not that there's necessarily a threat in it, but the figure of Jesus and the figure of Muhammad are different, right? And that's part of what I think, that's some of the tension for those of us looking on at the religion to help to understand that figure better.
Well, it's complex, of course, because the debate is ongoing about exactly what Jesus made of the Roman occupation, of traditional Jewish apparent collaboration with the Roman occupation. Some think he was actually a zealot, and that was airbrushed out of the texts later on for fear of panicking the Roman authorities. And I'm not really a New Testament expert. I can't comment on that. But clearly, in prophetic religion, there is a willingness to stick one's neck out and to make trouble when confronted by oppression and tyranny. And you see that a lot in the Hebrew prophets. And perhaps Christ, when he overturns the tables of the money changers in the temple, is making that kind of statement. Must have been quite a major operation, I guess. Looking at the Christian scriptures as they exist today, many Muslims confess themselves slightly disappointed that Christ is living in his own country, which is under a brutal foreign military occupation. And he doesn't seem to be fazed by that or saying anything against it. He even says, you know, help the legionary to carry his burden. Resist not him that is evil. Turn the other cheek. In ways which seem to be commendable, but when it's somebody else's cheek that's being smacked, you have a basic moral responsibility to intervene. So that pacifist portrait of Christ in the gospel sometimes seems a little bit thin and morally disappointing. I remember actually going back to my school days, our headmaster, speaking from the pulpit at Westminster Abbey, was talking about the render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's moment in the Gospels, and he actually preached against it. He said, this is wrong, this is evasive, he's not being frank, it's unclear, and he should speak out frankly, even if he endangers himself against the terrible things that are being done to his people. The subversion of their religion, the mass crucifixions, the horrors of Roman occupation. I remember that. So there is something in the sort of idea of the sort of hippie Christ wandering around Galilee with a daffodil preaching peace and love that certainly from the point of view of the 1970s, which is the kind of aftermath of the anti-colonial revolts, and one of the things we were into in school was opposing apartheid South Africa and South Africa's occupation of Namibia, that a gospel response to that didn't seem to be quite right to us, and that something a little bit more militant seemed to be morally appropriate, which is, after all, you know, what we've always done as a country, whatever has been the message of the gospel preached in the churches, we've always had a doctrine of just war. And I think that's a tension within some Christian theology, that the person of Christ in the Gospels is unmistakably pacifist. And yet following Augustine, the church came up with actually quite morally impressive ideas about just war, that you can defend yourself, you can defend the weak, you can fight against oppressors. So that tendency, I suppose, is what the prophet is already articulating, that if you're facing extermination at the hands of an evil pagan tyranny, you can defend yourself, which is what he did. So I found that story, I don't know if it's Che Guevara, but certainly a liberative story, something that, that spoke to me rather more than the somewhat bloodless and faint message on politics that seemed to be conveyed by the Gospels.
Yes, that's helpful. Thank you. I wanted to ask, you know, we started with hearing about the trajectory of the kind of Congregationalist ministers of your grandparents' generation and this modernist kind of mid-century 1960s rebellion against that. And then this 1970s seeking after all kinds of sources of the sacred that you were swept up in. I'm really interested in what you think is happening right now, because I am feeling this, certainly from when I took over at Theos 12, 13 years ago to now, this huge shift in how open people are to talk and think about spirituality and to even kind of express metaphysical yearnings. And we're seeing, you know, there's, I still don't know where we are, but there's this question about whether the few big public conversions, particularly to Orthodox Christianity, but others are happening, and tracing that to, is there a new desire for tradition, right? Is there a desire for rootedness, a reconnection with ancestors? One, I wanted to ask if you're seeing it in Islam as well. Is there a kind of spike of conversions? And if not generally, where are we in this moment with the spiritual landscape?
I think that, I mean, it even seems to be a scientific view that religiosity is kind of normative to human beings, and that its absence is almost a dysfunctional, even I saw a cheeky piece in the Daily Telegraph which said that actually atheism is a mental illness, because it's not what the brain is designed for. We're designed to make sense of the world and to flourish and to have children if we believe that there's a meaning behind things and that relationships are sacred, that the dead are honored and so forth. Since, you know, the old Stone Age, we've all been religious and we've all perceived the kind of deep transcendent mystery in virgin nature in particular. I don't think that can be extirpated from human beings. I think there's a deep disillusion with established religion. And sometimes that's almost a kind of prophetic desire to turn over the tables of the money changers and to say, your reverence, talk about something real, please. You have so many amazing things in your scripture that can inspire us. Why are you giving us this very thin gruel based on various late 20th century liberal ideas, which you believe you found in your scripture? We want something a little bit more spiky, controversial, countercultural. I think the young in particular look to religion as being prophetic, troublemaking and disruptive, because they can see that the modern world is in deep trouble. It's unstable, hasn't delivered on many of the promises of humanism. We have a major war going on now in Europe, in which, unfortunately, rival, church hierarchies are deeply implicated. We have worsening calamities in the Middle East. We have the rise of various forms of dangerous religionized nationalisms in the Islamic world, in India, among many Trump voters. Nobody's really off the hook when it comes to the political misinstrumentalization of religion. That puts a lot of people off. But there's also a sense that we are failing as a species, even though the population crisis is an example of that. We're not replicating ourselves. In Scotland now, the average woman has 1.3 babies, which is historically unprecedented. In South Korea, it's even worse, which even from a secular point of view has to indicate that as a species, we're failing. Not only are we threatening the habitat and the existence of countless thousands of other species, who also, this is a Quranic teaching, are nations like yourselves and have the right to praise God in their own way. Not only are we guilty of a kind of genocide against other living things, sentient beings that share the planet with us, but we're even not good to ourselves in that our own species is in danger. We're all getting old. We're not having babies. There's a profound dysfunction going on at the moment. And this all seems to be part of a larger problem. The desacralizing of nature can't be separated from the climate crisis. Artificial intelligence raises very alarming questions about possible replacement of humanity and can there be artificial intelligence? What happens if the internet wakes up one morning and says, well, I've got a lot of information about different religions and I've decided that I want to be Zoroastrian, so please explain how I practice that. All these completely new, challenging, mind-boggling things are being chucked at young people in particular. And there's a deep skepticism about the modern project. There are too many existential threats, and none of them are coming from religion, really. So there is a sense that, yeah, people do need to get back to that primordial Paleolithic sense of the imminent sanctity of nature, which is evoked in the Quran in particular, which is constantly telling us to look at God's signs in nature and to look at the way heaven and earth have been created. And the fact Muslim worship is directed by the movements of the solar system. The sun and the moon dictate the times of our services and our fasting month. So yes, I think a lot of people are alert now to the fact that they are naturally religiously thirsty. And we have seen in Muslim communities a big spike in conversions. So in our local mosque in Cambridge, we had 205 conversions registered last year, which is twice as many as the previous year. And since, paradoxically, perhaps the Gaza thing erupted, we've had also a number of conversions coming in from different communities, from every possible background. So the converts are a significant part of the British Muslim community now. There may be 150,000 or more active converts. And I suspect that they form part of a larger pattern of people moving into traditional forms of religion. You mentioned the growth in baptisms in the Orthodox churches. It may well be that something analogous is happening in Islam and quite possibly in other traditions as well. I don't know. But yeah, there is a sense of secular crisis which is making people think more respectfully about faith.
Yes. I want to end by asking, what is the key thing you've learned about how we do engage with people who are different from ourselves? And whether it's from your Islamic teaching or just from your experiences in life, for those listening thinking, gosh, we are getting more divided. I've struggled to see people different from myself. As fully human sometimes, I think, if we're all honest deep down. What helps us?
Well, some of those old religious stories, the idea that we have common ancestors, Adam and Eve, is really important. Everybody is a sibling, several times removed. The idea, which is shared by the monotheisms, that we're made in the image of God, conveys a certain, what in Islamic theology is called ismat al-adamiyya, the inviolability of Adamic descent. People are intrinsically inviolable. They may then go on to commit mass murder or whatever, but in themselves, they partake of the inviolability of the nobility of Adamic descent. There's Quranic verses which are important to me, such as the one that says, mankind, we have created you male and female and have made you tribes and nations that you might know one another. That's an important verse for me. The diversity of the world is not some kind of Tower of Babel curse. Tower of Babel's not in the Quran, but it's in fact a sign that God wishes his image to be presented in a rainbow-like diversity of different forms. And the uniqueness of every individual is something that, and again, Muslim poets like Rumi are always talking about how much you can learn about the divine just by considering the human face, not just the beauty of human beings, but also the deep mystery of the presence of a soul, which is conveyed in the formation of the human face. And I think that kind of sacred humanism is something that has to be cultivated in all of the religions, which have all fallen prey to stupid essentialism and fundamentalism and nationalism and Islamism in a way that is very untimely, given the human sacred hunger at the moment, that we need to return to that idea of, you know, the sanctity of human beings and the inviolability of everybody who is created in God's image. I think that theology needs to be resurrected as a matter of urgency.
Tim Winter, thank you so much for speaking to me on The Sacred.
Thank you. It's been an honour.
Well, what a fascinating and unusual man. I found trying to get inside Timothy's world really interesting, because so many different parts of it are worlds that I don't know very well. The first thing it's left me thinking about is formation. I'm almost always thinking about formation, as some of you know. But how are childhoods in particular, but really our whole lives, the thing we pay attention to, the relationships that we're in, how they shape us and form us. And I wonder if part of the reason that Timothy feels such an unusual kind of person to me is that he had two different, quite unusual, formative cultures in his childhood. You know, he was brought up in this famous modernist house in Highgate Cemetery. We've put a link to it in the show notes so you can go and have a look. And it's glass and a box. It's really very symbolic of that high modernist mid-20th century, you know, intellectual optimism about reason and this move away from, you know, the sort of superstitious, deadening, oppressive dark ages of religion. And that was very much what was going on in Timothy's home. And then at school, you have this strange sounding moment in a British public school. And bear in mind, this school is in the grounds of Westminster Cathedral. It's literally part of the quadrangle of the church. And they go to Westminster Cathedral every day. Not Westminster Cathedral, Westminster Abbey. Westminster Cathedral is the Catholic cathedral. And being living and studying within the Abbey must have had this historically dislocating effect, I can imagine. And then you've got the church, the school culture saying, you know, difference is great. Basically, it sounds like a breeding ground for old school British eccentrics. You know, difference is really celebrated, intellectual independence. And those two things shaped his childhood. And that really helps me make sense of this, both this intellectual mystical quest, and he used this tantalizing phrase, which I really wish I'd been braver at pushing him on, but it felt a bit private. He used this phrase, various maverick personal experiences, you know, which is one of those like understated, sociologically appropriate terms for, I imagine, religious encounters, right? He had that in his childhood, and he also had this encouragement to pursue quite niche interests, the combination of which led him to this position that he's in now. So formation, how it makes some choices seem more possible and some less possible for us. I wonder what your formation, what mark it left on you, what your imaginative possibilities are now because of that formation. The second thing I really noticed in this interview was it was really pushing my buttons about Jesus. And not, you know, Dr. Winter was very respectful. And this is exactly the point of this project, for me to listen to people coming from different perspectives who disagree with me on various things. But because Jesus is really very close to my, you know, very close to what's sacred to me and very precious, I was surprised to find myself really wanting to argue back with him, you know, really wanting to say, you know, that's not the only way to read Jesus. What he sees as sort of morally disappointing in Jesus's pacifism is one of the ways that you can frame it. I find the most morally beautiful teaching that's ever been written. So that was helpful for me to have one of those moments of like, oh gosh, you can really see very different things in this text. And similarly with his understanding of the Christian sexual ethics, just not my read at all, but so helpful to get that view from the outside and just listen, not argue, just listen and seek to understand. And the final thing I'm left with is really a concept that I've been playing with really for the last years that I wrote about in the Roth chapter of Fully Alive, using the phrase from John Yates, people like me syndrome, this deep-seated tendency in us all to prefer people that remind us of ourselves, and how anything that strikes us as other, you know, foreign, different, not like me, has a tendency to trigger us into feeling uncomfortable or even hostile or unsure. And I think for a lot of us, individually and collectively, Islam has played that role at different points down the centuries. You know, there's peaks of it around particular historical moments. It's interesting that at the moment around the Christian nationalism conversation, it's really there. And some of these high profile conversions seem to be to Christianity seem to be placing themselves in opposition to Islam. And other groups have played this role down the centuries, you know, Jews tragically and too often Catholics in the UK at different points. But Islam is often one of those symbols, ciphers, stories that those outside that community see as really not like me, you know, really triggering their people like me syndrome. And I could really hear Dr. Winter wanting to complicate that and say it's not that different, right? That he doesn't consider himself having leapt a million miles away from Christianity, that he sees continuity and similarity and connectedness between these Abrahamic faiths. He called them Semitic monotheisms, which was one of various new terms that I learned in this interview. And again, I think that's really helpful for us. And I heard it again, that people like me thing playing out when I asked him about his childhood, about his parents and how they reacted to him converting to Islam. And he said, basically, my mum was okay with it when she realized other middle of the road, middle class men were converting. And that's exactly how this works in us, that something can seem very different, possibly threatening because it's very different. But if we see someone like us who reminds us of ourselves involved in it, it's like a bridge. We can say, oh, maybe it's not so strange after all. Maybe it's something I could at least listen to and seek to understand rather than retreat from or attack. It was just one of those classic demonstrations of the way people like me syndrome works. Oh, there's someone like me. Maybe it's not so bad. Lots more I could say, but I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and our production team is Lizzie Harvey, Dan Turner, and Amari Ugandran. The Sacred is a project of the think tank Theos, and there is loads of brilliant work from our colleagues going on. So please do check that out, and particularly Reading Our Times, which is our sister podcast. I really like hearing your thoughts. You can find me at my Substack, which is morefullyalive.substack.com, on social media. Although I'm trying to dial down my presence there, I probably will see it eventually. Or you can reach us on the Sacred email, which we'll also put in the show notes. Until next episode, I hope you can be reflecting on who function as people like me and people not like me in your life, and how you could approach them with a little bit more curiosity and see what happens.